Hey, it's Andy. Thanks for downloading this podcast. It's a good one. You're really going to like it. And you know, if you like good things, you should also check out the movie deep dive podcast that Mike Pusateri and I did on The Right Stuff.
Now, what are you two pudknockers going to have, huh?
And we are going to break down the 1983 classic, The Right Stuff. And now you're all like, that's great. You morons picked a movie that's 37 years old.
The movie, it was just so stylized in such a unique way that I had never seen. I can never recall seeing a film like that. Really, was how unique it was in their presentation of it and the filming, and that really drew me to that movie. And I think it still makes it really rewatchable. Yeah. I've probably seen it 10 to 15 times, and would watch it again this week.
Hey, Ridley, you got any payment?
Yeah, I think I got a stick.
Loan me some, will you? I'll pay you back later.
Fair enough.
It's available now on the Pointless Exercise podcast feed, wherever podcasts are sold for free.
Or why don't you fix your little problems and light this candle?
Welcome back to another exciting edition of the Pointless Exercise podcast. It's time to remember this crap with Mike Donahue. Mike, how are you doing?
Never been better, Andy.
That's great.
What can I tell you? Yeah.
So the Bears, the hottest team in pro football,
woo!
Winners of five in a row. No, that's right. Losers of five in a row are facing one of the teams they actually beat earlier this season. Do you know who the interim head coach of the Detroit Lions is?
Oh, jeez, I don't. So they just got rid of...
I had to look it up yesterday.
That Belichick branch or trunk and Patricia. You know what? It's not Jim Bob Cooter, is it?
No, and that's exactly what I said on the podcast last night. I was like,
I stole that from you. Joe Mullen. You remember Joe Mullen?
Is that the guy that was naked in the drive-thru?
Believe it was.
Yeah. All right. That is who they should hire.
Tell me he's their coach.
It is the great Daryl Bevel.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Probably best known for his play calling at the goal line.
Yep.
In Super Bowl, would it be 51?
I don't know the numbers or the letters.
Well, Manning's was 50, but maybe that's the one he blew. So I don't. Yeah, maybe it was 49. But
Daryl,
yeah, Seattle,
best remembered as a very
as a Brady
as a college quarterback at Wisconsin, correct?
And that's
then,
right.
A non-factor as a pro. I don't know that he ever made it. I'm sure he was a backup somewhere, and now a very mediocre offensive coordinator for lots of teams.
Did he not make magic with Brett Favre the first year that the latter came to Minnesota? I want to say he was Minnesota's coordinator in 2010, or 2009, I should say.
Oh, I'm sure.
That was before his infamy in the Super Bowl.
He has
he?
Here's where he's coached. He coached at Westmar.
How's that?
I don't know what that is. That must be a college, I think.
Westmar.
Iowa State. Okay. He was a
grad assistant. Ames, Iowa.
Then he was a wide receiver coach at Connecticut. Then off to the NFL, where he was the quarterback coach for the Packers for 2 years. Wide receivers. Oh, I'm reading. Is it above or below? Good Lord. Reading's hard. Assistant quarterbacks coach for 2 years. He's the assistant to the quarterback coach.
Right.
Then he was the quarterback coach for 3 years. Those would have been his Favre years.
With Favre, right.
2000, 2005.
But Favre followed him to Minnesota eventually.
Yes, then he was the offensive coordinator for the Vikings for five seasons.
So that's his first legit gig.
Yes, then to Seattle for seven.
Uh-huh, but never as a head coach, right? He didn't get promoted out of Minnesota.
No, offensive coordinator in Minnesota, in Seattle, then in Detroit now since 2019, and starting Sunday, the head coach.
So he's never been a head coach anywhere then?
No.
I would have thought his number would have come up before now. And of course, it comes up under terrible circumstances.
I don't know if he's ever really been good anywhere. That could be a problem. Otherwise, Matt Nagy didn't stop him.
It did not.
He got to be a head coach.
yeah, Nagy had the benefit of not putting together any sort of big body of work, which sort of seems to be the blueprint, right? Because Trubisky didn't have any kind of body of work, which some people might think, oh, that would show lack of experience. But no, and Ryan Pace's galaxy brain, that just means there are surprises that can be unleashed along the way.
So when I think about the Lions, you know, they've been bad for so long.
Mm-hmm. Historically long.
Then where my mind immediately went was what one thing they have in common with the Bears is that they have, although they actually topped the Bears.
In playoff appearances in the last 10 years?
No, it's even better. If Calvin Johnson gets elected to the Hall of Fame this year in his first year of eligibility, the Bears and the Lions will have four of the – I got to count on the podcast again. One, two, five. Four of the six youngest Hall of Famers ever.
Okay, like the year that they were inducted?
Their age when they were inducted.
Gale Sayers?
Gale Sayers is the youngest. 34 years old when he got inducted.
Willie Gallimore did not get – he got his number retired, number 28, but I'm sure he's not in the Hall of Fame. So he died in a car crash after the 63 championship. Bears and Lions. So Calvin Johnson would be one of the four?
He will be one of the six youngest, and the Bears and Lions will have four.
Four. So say wow, Johnson did. Oh, Sanders, right? He retired early.
Barry Sanders, 36 years old, tied for the third youngest.
Okay, and
the other one I would not have known, which is so the other Bear.
Wow. Holy cripes. Would it be Doug Atkins?
I would not. He played with Doug.
He did?
Yes.
So 63 Bear?
Played after that.
Okay. Well, it's not Doug Buffonet.
No, it's not.
Not Hall of Famer. It's not Ed Obradovich. Is it Butkus?
It is Dick Butkus.
Yeah, because his career was also truncated because of knee injuries.
So the thing the Bears have going for them is that their two youngest Hall of Famers ever inducted is because of injury. The Lions, right. Two, is they got to 30 and went, fuck it. I do not want to play for this team anymore.
I don't see any promise ahead. It's just not worth it.
You know, but just they had to, like, drag off the field with his – you could hear his bones rubbing together. Sayers played an entire last season basically – running like a fullback just to prove that he could still play.
These guys were fit.
Barry and Calvin are both prime. Like, see ya. We're done.
Oh, man.
You guys that's suck fantastic. And not getting better, and we're going home.
That sums it up. So who are, out of curiosity, who are the other two in the top six?
The other two are Jim Brown.
Okay, yeah.
He's the second youngest. He was 35 when he got inducted.
And Sayers is the youngest.
Yes. And then the other guy is a guy we talked about.
Ooh,
I don't know how many weeks ago. Well, when the Bears played Tennessee, we talked about
Earl Campbell.
Earl Campbell, yes.
Yeah.
In fact, we've talked about a lot of these guys on the youngest. So Sarah's the youngest, then Brown, then a three-way tie: Butkus, Campbell, and Barry Sanders. Then Kellen Winslow.
We've talked about him.
Then Bambi. Lance Allworth. Eric
That's
Dickerson.
First mentioned. Talked about him.
OJ.
Didn't talk about him, OJ. I don't believe. Yeah, no, not in any context. I don't think. Maybe we did.
The Bears are all over this list. They've got two guys that tied. I don't know how many they listed here. One, two, three, four. Well, they just went up to age 39. They had two guys who were 39 when they got inducted. Do you want to take a guess? They're both... of fairly recent vintage, which I guess gives it away.
So basically, to get into 39 means you had to retire at 34.
Yeah, and you had to be a, and then you need to be a first ballot Hall of Famer.
That's what I mean. Was Singletary?
Yes. And one of his teammates.
And, but not Hampton. Was it Dent?
Nope. This is what I would have thought, because he had a long career.
No, and Hampton didn't get in right away. No. So Singletary, yeah, Hampton had to wait. Long career. Teammates. He was on the 85 Bears?
On the 85 Bears.
Did he? Oh, Covert. Did nope. Covert get in? No, he hasn't gotten in, right?
No, Dan Pompey wants the Bears to find the next one. But
because you could argue that Covert's career was also cut short, which is kind of one of the grounds.
What the hell is wrong? He retired in 1990, and he was drafted in
83, yes. But he was obviously never in. You know, so that's the combination to retire young and get in right away.
Not this guy. The last guy had a – no one – well, I mean, we wanted to see him stick around, but he had a full career. He is the greatest Chicago Bear of all time.
Did I already mention Peyton?
No. Unless I missed this, I talked over.
Because Peyton had a long career. So what's the trick question here? What am I missing?
He must have retired at 34.
He retired at 34.
Retired at his number. That's why he quit. He said, I met my number. I'm going home. Because he was 39. But yeah, he had.
When he got it.
So he was clearly young when he entered the league.
But it felt like he had such a long career. You're talking about Peyton,
yes,
right?
Walter Peyton. But
that's just a list of guys that got into 39.
Eddie Peyton didn't get in.
Right. But Walter and Eddie did combine for the most NFL rushing yards, just like Hank and Tommy Aaron at one point combined for the...
Walter was 21 when he broke in 1975 and played until 1987, retired at 34. 33. Okay. He retired at 33.
Yeah, but he had a long career. Well, or it's not that he had a long career. I think it's the fact that he missed so few games. He played a lot of games.
Yes.
That was still probably a longer than average career. I mean, like, you know, Campbell had come and gone by that. Peyton was still playing. So it was a little bit of a
13 seasons as the lead ball carrier. So he got hit a lot. Never got hurt.
It feels
like he played forever. But he was still a young man when he retired. Good Lord, if he had Frank Gordon, he'd have 25,000 yards.
So Frank Gordon probably
he'd have died of liver cancer on the field. But
right. So Frank Gore has wormed his way into the top 10. I'm guessing, right? All time rushing yards.
Yeah, well, he's got a lot.
You know, I remember when we were kids.
He's the Frank O'Harris of our.
Yeah. Generation. It was always Jim Brown number one, OJ number two, when it kind of came into focus, because just like around that time when, like, you know, Steve Carlton and Tom Seaver and Nolan Ryan were like all gearing down and being like only like the fourth, fifth, and sixth guys or, you know, never throw 3,000 strikeouts. Peyton and Harris were bearing down on that all-time rushing mark, and it felt like it'd been there together. At one point, Jim Taylor was like fourth. I guarantee you, Jim Taylor today is probably like 25th. and that list now looks totally different. Peyton's probably still in the top 10, but he's right. He's probably second or third. I mean, he's only been surpassed by Emmett, right? Emmett's the all timer, right? I don't even know anymore off the top of my head.
Well,
Peyton broke Jim Brown's record in 84 and then was still a 1400 yard a season rusher for two more years.
All right. Walter is still second. Third,
16,726
with 15,868 yards, and if he ever passes Walter, it's a travesty. Is Frank Gore?
In no way.
Yes, he's the third all time.
Holy cow! He's like the Jamie Moyer
leading rusher.
Yeah.
Then Barry, who that was the other thing. Not only did he quit at 30 with one of his typical years, he would have been very close.
Well, he would have beaten Emmett there, I'm sure, right? He would have gotten there before Emmett.
Yeah, he would have broke. He would have been played, the right direction.
And if he played four or five more years, Emmett never would have caught him.
No.
Wow. That just not that we needed further pronunciation on life as a lion. So not only did he, you know, not want to play anymore healthy, he didn't even, you know, he passed up an opportunity for all-time legacy.
Jim Brown is now 11th.
Wow, not even in the top 10.
No, the players ahead of him in ascending order. Tony Dorsett.
Eric Dickerson. I didn't know. Dorsett eventually passed Brown then. Interesting.
Yes, by about 400 yards.
Jesus. That's
it. His last year. Well, maybe his last year. I don't know. Eric Dickerson, the bus. LaDainian Tomlinson. Curtis Martin. And then Adrian Peterson.
Okay, and Peterson still can move up. Scored a couple touchdowns last week, so we're going to see him Sunday, right? He's a Lion.
He is a Lion, yes. Bears already shut him down once, I'm sure. Actually, yeah, he played against him, and he just signed. Rolled in like the day before, and he ran for 93 yards against the Bears.
Yeah, he had some runs in that game. He's actually looking pretty good this year. You know, kudos to him. Granted, he lost an entire season to an ACL. Peyton never lost, more than one game, but I don't know.
He is averaging 3.7 yards a carry.
Okay, it's not Hall of Fame level, but he doesn't need to be.
He has
so he might move
that 93 is the most he's had by a lot. But he gets the Bear run defense again, so
is that right?
He's good for
it's about just season high.
Actually, he had 75 yards against the Cardinals, but it took him 22 carries to get it.
I don't even know what I'm talking about. Then I just happened to look up on Thanksgiving and saw him score two touchdowns.
Yeah, he scored two touchdowns.
Just assumed he was
15 for 55, two touchdowns against the mighty Texans.
Jesus, no, he's done. Terrible. He's not climbing up that list. But Frank Gore, what did you just so I can keep a track? I don't think I have to worry about it because. But what is he? You say 15,800 something, and I know Peyton was 16. I want to say 726.
16,726.
Okay.
So 15,868. So
less than 1,000 yards.
Yeah, and at his current pace, if Frank plays five more years, he'll pass.
Walter. Frank Gore was in that 2002 NCAA championship, one of the few times the Big Ten prevailed. Didn't he tear his leg up in that game, or am I thinking
that was another Willis McGahee that did that?
That's right. Okay, so still,
but Frank was on that team, but Willis is the one who got
hurt. He was on that
team. Frank last year ran for 599 yards.
By the way, Jerry Payton
for the Bills. He ran for five, and he's run for 521 so far for the Jets. So I don't think he's going to catch Walter because I think he's probably done. Oh, it would be a dumbass thing like the Bears will sign him next year, and he'll end up passing Walter as a Bear.
That would be the most ridiculous self-owned by a McCaskey family that's made a legacy
actually,
out of it.
No, this is if Nagy's still a coach. If the Bears want to make sure Gore never passes Peyton, that's what they do. They sign him. And then there's no way.
On the bench.
Well, I know he can play. The way they run the ball and the way Nagy runs it, there's no way he'll ever get enough yards.
How many yards did Emmett finish with?
Eight.
That's a good point.
I just left it. 18,355.
I'm sorry. He really blew the door. Just like Peyton blew the doors off of Brown's record.
Never say never, but I don't think anybody's ever going to pass Emmett.
No.
Because they don't run the ball enough anymore.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And there's nobody other than Frank and APE. And I know his initials are AP, but he thinks his nickname is AD. The next active player is Mark Ingram of the Ravens, although they have Marshawn Bold. I don't think Marshawn is on a team right now.
Where does he rank, Marshawn?
Lynch is the 29th all-time leading rusher, in between Eddie George and Otis Anderson. But the real active one is Mark Ingram. He is 61st all-time, behind Leroy Kelly and George Rogers. And he has 7,257 yards. Marshall. So, he just needs 11,000 more, and then he'll catch him. Yeah. Man. There are a lot of...
Well, kudos to Emmett. Reluctantly. Obviously, I wasn't happy to see anybody break Sweetness's record.
Yeah. I was glad it wasn't Barry, just because Barry's a lion. Although I always liked Barry more than Emmett, because Emmett always
seemed kind of a... I did too. Well, and I have always had somewhat of an aversion to cowboy. I hated Tony Dorsett too.
Yeah,
I think it was a Cowboys thing, a sort of that sort of pretty boy thing where they were all really good. And yeah, I'll leave it at that.
So the other thing I thought would be fun, because I was thinking about the Lions and thinking about the Bears' lot in life, stuck with Ryan Pace and Matt Nagy. Mm-hmm. I thought it'd be fun to look at the first-round draft picks of the greatest general manager in Detroit Lions history, Matt Millen.
Uh-huh. I just want, before you get started, I'm no expert. I'm really a dumbass. So, you know, but I remember the day the Lions hired Matt Millen, and the Bears themselves are sort of in that late Wonstadt, early Jerron malaise. And so we didn't really have that much to get excited about, but still, I remember the day he got hired, and he was like John Madden light, right? He was the personality in the broadcast booth. One of the top guys. I knew he was a dumbass.
Yeah.
And when he got hired, I just remember thinking that, okay, if the Bears can kind of get their shit straight, that's one team they're not going to have to worry about for the next 4 or 5 years. And even then, I did not think how beyond accurate my prediction would be, because they were actually probably even more laughable with Millen. So carry on.
So he was there for 8 drafts.
Didn't he draft a wide receiver like 9 years in a row in the first round?
Half of his first round picks are wide receivers. Objectively, he had one excellent pick, one good pick, and 6 god-awful, holy shit, how did you do it?
Yeah.
His one good pick was his first pick. The Penn State man took an offensive tackle from Michigan named Jeff Backus.
Oh, yeah, he had a good career.
Yeah, Backus played 12 years, played 186 games in a row. He wasn't great, but he was good. He was a dependable tackle, and those are actually worth it. And he was the 18th pick in the draft, so that's an excellent pick.
Yeah. All right.
So he's off to a great start.
Good start. Uh-huh.
Then, 2002, it's time to get your quarterback.
So, oh, Joey Harrington.
Joey Harrington. Yeah. The great Joey Harrington.
Mr. Pianist.
He was a pianist, all right.
And then I know that 03 was a Michigan State pick, moment of silence for Charles Rogers, right? Is that his top pick in 03? Because I think that's what began his run. He drafted a wide receiver like 3 or 4 years in a row.
Okay, this is funny. The site I'm looking at is must be a Detroit radio station. Oh, it's East Lansing radio station. And it's Where Are They Now? And so although this is a little old, but this still applies. Well, it doesn't apply to Charles anymore because he's dead. Right. But at the time, here's what they wrote. Charles Rogers, he was the second overall pick in the draft.
Uh-huh.
He played, how many NFL seasons do you think Charles Rogers played?
No more than 3.
3, right on the, yes, uh-huh. 3.
He had a big first game, too, in Arizona. Him and Anquan Boldin got off to a good start. But anyway.
He scored 4 career touchdowns. And then the third bullet, and most of these have 5 or 6 bullets, but Charles only gets 3, was currently in legal trouble. Well, not anymore. He got out of it.
He did. By perishing.
So in 2002, the first pick was David Carr. Second pick was Julius Peppers. Went to the Panthers. Then Joey went. Then we had Mike Williams, the tackle, Quentin Jammer, Ryan Sims, Bryant McKinney.
The Bears were in the playoffs the year before, so their Mark Colombo pick didn't happen to the bottom of that round.
Yes, 29th overall. Right. So, I mean, Joey Harrington was not a good pick, but there wasn't a lot to pick there.
No.
You kind of give him a pass. But that doesn't explain then. Well, then he goes, well, let's look at 2003.
And he got drafted after Rodgers.
Should have cued all.
And that would have been Michael Haynes and Rex Grossman were first-round picks for the Bears that year. So, I mean, Grossman, say what you want. He had a better career than Rodgers. So that's one that was better.
That's the only Rodgers he had a better career than. Picked after maybe. After Charles Rogers in 03. Andre Johnson to Houston.
Great player so for a while.
Didn't even get the best wide receiver in the draft, picking second.
That's right. That's how,
Dwayne Robertson to the Jets. Terrence Newman to the Cowboys, who played forever. And somebody named Jonathan Sullivan, defensive tackle. Byron Leftwich.
Sully. Okay. Wow. Leftwich was the 03 draft.
Yeah, Terrell Suggs went 10th. Then that's who the Bears career. Wanted. And they, I think they
why
were,
did they take him? That's when they settled for Michael Haynes.
Yes. They're, they wanted to pair Rex.
The poor man's Terrell
and
Suggs.
They thought they were going to get Rex and Suggs. Instead, they got Haynes and Suggs. Anyway.
Yeah, well, they didn't pass on Suggs, though.
No, they thought they were going to get him. That's who they were going to pick. Uh-huh. Still playing.
Well, the Bears sucked in 02, so which one of those, what was the first pick?
Haynes was 14th. He was the 14th pick. Four picks after. Okay.
That's a pretty bad pick, though.
Yeah, it's a terrible pick. Let's see who they could have had. Who got drafted right behind them?
Who drafted after Michael Haynes, besides Grossman, who was obviously the best
Was this
pick.
Guy any good? I don't remember. Troy Polamalu? Was he any good?
Oh, boy.
Two picks after.
Fucking Steelers.
And then the aforementioned, Willis McGahee went after Rex. Dallas Clark.
With a bum knee and all. Yeah. If McGahee hadn't blown out his knee, right? That was 03 draft. 02 season.
Wani would have taken him. It was just the wrong.
Right.
It's just the wrong.
Pat Riley,
the wrong
Pat
guy
Riley
in charge. Right. Taking him. And I didn't remember this. Did you know that the Chargers, with the 30th pick, they drafted Sammy Davis? I didn't.
Hey,
didn't
baby.
Know he played football.
Hey.
One eye and little. I mean, that's kind of a reach at 30. But
right, bow tie. Hell, had some good pipes though. Kid could sing.
All right, so back to the Lions. So they've taken Charles Rogers in 2003, 2004. He got the 7th pick. You don't need a wide receiver, do you? Well, you always need two. So yeah. Former Bear
Roy Williams. Yeah, future Bear, which actually emerges into this like fiery ball of white hot anger. Roy Williams was one moment with the Bears, in the 22 that stretch of games during the Caleb Hay, after, you know, we talked about the Bears in 2011, we're like 7-2 cruising, they knock off Rivers in San Diego at the in Soldier Field, you know, they'd gone to the title game the year before, but Cutler happened to got injured in that game, out for the rest of the year, but they still had some real weak teams that they got to play. They couldn't beat any of them, but the one that will just haunt me, and whenever I hear Roy Williams' name, I just, like I said, I just turn in, I just, this is white hot furious anger. It was a game against the Chiefs, real frustrating game. The Bears offense wasn't doing anything. Chiefs start the laughably inept Tyler Palko. He can't do anything. And then they bring in Kyle Orton, former Bear, off the bench right before halftime. And Orton proceeds to like throw a pass and hit his hand in somebody's helmet and have to come right back out of the game. But somehow the Chiefs get a Hail Mary right before halftime. And the Bears just can't get out of their own way on offense. But they finally, like in the third quarter, you know, it's still a close game. It's just a real crappy game. Bears were the super. Your team within the 5-yard line, right? I don't know what the score would be. I think it was a 1-score game. It was like 10-3 or whatever. And this is the 1 year that Roy Williams is on the Bears. He didn't do a goddamn thing. And throws a pass to him right at the goal line. And he's open. And it's not a bad pass. He should catch it. And not only does he not catch it, but he managed just sort of knock it up in the air and allows a Chiefs defender to grab on it and fall down in the end zone for a touchback. So yeah, I mean, I have lots of examples of irrational anger, but really the Bears just, you know, win one of those games, you know, in hope that Cutler can come back. They fell out of it so quickly. It didn't even matter, but that was a game right there. And that was a moment. Went right there. Williams, if he did one thing the entire season, catch the damn ball. Not only does he not do it, but he turns it into a turnover. So that rant's over. Let's go back to the fact that the Lions drafted that schmuck in 2004. For the second straight year, they drafted a receiver. And the next year, they drafted one again, right?
Yep. So the 2004 draft, pretty good. Eli Manning, Robert Gallery, not so good. Then Larry Fitzgerald, mm-hmm. Philip Rivers, Sean Taylor, rest in peace. Kellen Winslow Jr. in prison. Then Roy. Then D'Angelo Hall, Jay Cutler's buddy. Threw three interceptions to him in a game once. Ben Roethlisberger was in that first round.
I remember that.
The Bears.
That's a good draft, man.
The Bears made a short-term investment.
2004, that was Tommy Harris.
Tommy Harris, and it paid off almost perfectly. He got hurt 1 year too soon, you know, a few weeks too soon.
Yep.
Everybody knew he was a great player with terrible great knees. Player. And the Bears basically said, it's the NFL. You're lucky to get 5 years out of a guy. Let's take the best guy. And he was objectively...
It wasn't actually a bad strategy. He was like a top five
talent. Drafted 14th, but with the knowledge that he wasn't going to have a long career.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that was actually a very nice pick.
Yeah.
Kudos to Jerry Angelo.
Jerry Angelo. That's a hell of a draft overall.
Yes.
And even then, the Lions underwhelmed.
Yeah, they managed to botch it, which is fine. So in 2005, okay, you've taken wide receivers the last 2 years. Certainly, you're not going to take anymore. I love the bullets under this. So they drafted Mike Williams, the tight end sized wide receiver from USC, 10th overall. The bullets under this are 2 years with the Lions, 5 career NFL touchdowns, and then the third bullet, released from the Toronto Argonauts in 2013.
He had a pretty long career up there. Well, I hardly remember Mike Williams.
I don't know that he actually...
I knew it was a receiver. I know, but at one point I knew that because I knew they drafted a wide receiver in the first 3 years. Obviously, I wouldn't be able to name them all because I'd forgotten that Mike, you know... Wow. And so was Millen still the GM for the next draft before?
Yes. Oh, yeah. He keeps going here for a while. So that draft, that was Alex Smith, number one. Then some slappy went 24th to the Packers that year. I don't even remember who it was.
We're talking the 2005. Who was that?
The slappy quarterback who went to the Packers at 24. I think you've heard of him. He's still there.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, it cut out for a second. Yeah, 2005. Got it.
The top five that year, Alex Smith, Ronnie Brown to the Dolphins, Braylon Edwards Ronnie Brown to the Dolphins, Braylon Edwards to the Browns, Cedric Benson to the Bears, Cadillac Williams to Tampa.
To the Browns, yep. That's right.
There really was a whole lot of Pac-Man went 6th to Tennessee. So then it gets better, of course, for the Lions. It gets better right after. The best part of the draft is right after Mike Williams. Dallas took DeMarcus Ware. The Chargers took Sean Merriman.
Whose last college game was against... Okay.
And then Thomas Davis to the Panthers.
By the way, DeMarcus Ware's last... college game was against NIU.
Troy? What bowl game was that?
Yep. That was like the... I can't remember now. It was the first one that NIU finally broke through. You know, I remember they had those some good teams for a while, but kept losing to Toledo and couldn't get into a bowl. And they finally did they won the bowl game, and DeMarcus Ware was on Troy. It was a... I can't even remember. Was it the Independence Bowl?
Yeah.
Probably, or is it one of the newfangled ones?
Probably the California Almond
Bowl. Wasn't the Blue Bonnet Bowl.
It was the Silicon Valley Bowl. That's what it was.
Okay. Well, there you go. Of course.
Who would forget? Didn't you go? Where'd you sit? I was right over. I was on the 30-yard line.
surely you know people that went to the Orange Bowl in 20, what was it? I guess it'd be 2013, 2012, I think.
You know, I don't think I do. I don't think I know anybody who went.
Made it down there.
I mean, I know people who work at Northern who went, but I don't know just like, you know,
yeah,
alums. You know, there were, you know, it was a once in a lifetime. I was a Michiganer. If I was here, I would have gone.
I mean, what, because we're that much closer to Florida?
Honestly, yes. Like, it was, you couldn't get, you can't get to anywhere from Traverse City. And so, fuck it. I just watched it on TV.
Well, right. You're 3 hours in Michigan, regardless of what direction you go.
Well, I mean, you'd fly down, and you have to fly out. You have to always connect, and then I just didn't. I just,
you could do Gerald Ford. You could go to Grand Rapids. Even that's a couple hours, though, from there.
NIU won that game, 34-21. So, ha. Screw.
Yeah, screw to Marcus, right? Ware. Yeah.
That was great. Right. Garrett Wolf.
Okay, future Bear.
Future Bear. All right.
That's what there's a memorable draft pick from would have been from 2007 draft, year after the Super Bowl.
Okay, so in 06, Millen, they finally tell him you can't draft a wide receiver. You're fired if you do it. So he says, fine. That's ridiculous. We don't need to draft wide receivers for a long time. We're set. I'm going with Ernie Sims from Florida State, outside linebacker. He played 3 years with the Lions.
Jesus.
One of the bullets under it was co-captain of the 2008 0-16 team.
There's a feather in his cap.
He got traded to the Eagles in 2010. And then in 2007, he made Calvin. His one great pick. Yes. So
Calvin was still a Matt Millen pick then, huh?
He was. And Matt made one more draft after that.
It's like a gambler that's just chasing his losses.
Well,
I got to get another receiver.
The Lions wouldn't fire him until he went 0-16.
That was fine. Wow.
So his last, yeah. So Calvin Johnson, 2007, one of the greatest wide receivers in NFL history. Objectively, it's a bad pick. The reason it's a bad pick is because in the last 4 years, you drafted three wide receivers. You shouldn't have had room for him. But because they were all terrible, actually, Roy was still on the team. The other two were, you know, gone, basically.
Okay, yeah.
Then it's like, fine, we can justify it again because we still haven't fixed it. terrible. And then his last pick, offensive tackle, Gosder Chiralis.
And how many years is he in the league or with the Lions? Because what astonishes me, and I'm sure it's not a whole lot better for the Bears, but how many of these first-round picks were gone in 3 years?
Joe Harrington, 4 years. Charles, 3. Roy Williams, 5 before he got traded to the Cowboys.
Yeah, he actually had some value.
Ernie Sims, 3. Then Calvin played 10 years.
And Mike Williams, 3.
Yeah, it was – not only did they fail, they failed spectacularly and fast.
Well,
that's like a business school thing. You're supposed to fail fast,
right?
So you don't lose it. That does not work with draft picks.
Well, here's my question: did they have like diamonds in the rough later? Because like Jerry Angelo he struggled with first round picks, but he also drafted Tillman and Briggs, you know, in later rounds. And same with, frankly, Ryan Pace, where he's picked up some guys in the later rounds. I mean, did Millen even like stumble ass backwards into like a third round pick that worked out?
No, I'm sure.
Even
I mean, if you could close your eyes and throw darts at a dartboard, and you're going to hit somebody once in a while. The thing about the late round picks, like, okay, now, yes, Jerry was good at it. Jerry. I don't know if he was good at it. What it says to me is you don't know how to set up a draft board unless you are. He's the exception to everything. Bill Belichick, because Belichick is actively targeting those late round guys and trading picks to get extra ones, because he wants the longest time, their whole strategy with building a roster was, well, first they got lucky. They had the cheap quarterback, which is the dream, but then you get to a point where, okay, we have a great quarterback. We have to pay him. And we're going to bring in guys on 1 or 2 year free agent deals, because they don't sign long free agent deals with anybody. And the reason we're able to afford a few top heavy guys is we're going to have all these league minimum guys who actually play for us, who aren't just special teamers, but are like half our defense is going to be guys who we picked in the fourth round or later, who are good players, who we're going to let go when they get expensive. They're going to go play for some else, because we're going to bring in another, you know, a group behind them.
I mean, that looks good on paper, but you still got to keep hitting with these guys, which I think part it helps to have also like a winning culture, but to get that off the ground, I think, where then you can bring in like free agents that, you know, might take, you know, LeGarrette Blount, like all through the years, they had, you know, Randy Moss at the end of his career. I mean,
I think the biggest difference between guys like, well, guys like Belichick and the other guys who've stuck around for a long time, like future Bear coach Jim Harbaugh's brother John.
He's still there, isn't he?
Yes. What they and Mike Tomlin, what they seem to have is like their culture. Although Tomlin drives me crazy with his "the standard is the standard." That is, you didn't say right, anything. That sentence doesn't mean anything.
I know, but there's no arguing like you said with the year in and year out success of all three of those teams.
The thing they seem to have in common is they know how they want to play, and so they can look for certain traits at certain positions. And if a player they think has those, then a late round pick for them seems like a guy like this guy thinks actually going to fit. And if he doesn't, what did we invest? Nothing. Where Ryan Pace's whole thing seems to be as the, you know, especially we get to the middle of the draft is, all right, who's the smallest guy I can draft? Because that to me is fun. I want a 5'3" running back, and then I want, hey, how about I trade up and let's get a 5'6" wide receiver? Yeah, it's like.
That's the other thing. Well, and you're the one that brings us up. And I was thinking about it tonight, just listening to the score and how infuriating, like how little regard he has for actual draft picks, right? Let alone, you know, right. Leaving alone the fact that he obviously swung and missed on Mitch. But like, you know, even the Mac deal doesn't look so great now. And so the short-term gain of getting Mac, the cost of that was first round picks they didn't have, right? When they all the guys like David Montgomery, like he's trading picks to get them. He's just burning draft picks. And Belichick's philosophy, as you explain it, is basically the opposite. You know, there's a lot of value in those, and I'm not just going to throw them out willy-nilly.
Right. Pace trades multiple picks to get a pick. Belichick trades a pick to get multiple picks. They are the exact opposite. And
or he trades a player.
And they've traded with each other because of that. Because I'm sure Belichick's like, all right, who are the irrational short-term thinker GMs? Those are the guys I want to call on draft day because I can swindle them out of a couple of picks. And it's not even – the guys that he has traded up for have not been worth it. Correct. Or the ones that have been worth it, they didn't need to trade up for. Like to me, it's the height of ridiculousness that they traded an extra pick for the chance to draft David Montgomery in the third round. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is the epitome of a fungible replacement level running back. He's fine.
He really is. And having watched him for 2 years, yeah.
But how could you sit there and go, oh my God, if David Montgomery doesn't fall to us, I'm going to die. The dumbest trade in NFL history was him trading from 3 to 2 to get Mitch in a draft that had even if you were deluded enough to think Mitch was good, then you thought there were 3 good quarterbacks. So you're sitting at 3, no matter what happens, you're getting one of them. You don't have to budge at all. In fact, a savvy GM would have been able to go the other way a few picks. But he had no concept. He was sure that somebody was trying to trade up to 2 to steal Mitch from him. Oh, God, I wish somebody had. But nobody else is that dumb. So nobody was going to do that. So at least Matt Millen had the decency to sit exactly where his pick was and then screw it up. He drafted like a man. I have the 8th pick. I'm going to pick 8th. And I'm just going to take the biggest heavy-legged wide receiver I can find. That's going to be great. You got to appreciate a man with a strategy. Okay, so we were talking about, for a brief moment, about the great Darrell Bevell. And that brings to mind great interim Detroit Lions coaches in history. And I think we both have the same favorite one.
There are more than a few, aren't there?
Yes, but the year was 2000.
Okay.
Bobby Ross was coaching the Lions, and about the middle of the season, his team put up an effort that Bobby really didn't like, so Bobby quit. He said, screw it, I'm out of here, go away. Later on, he said, I had blood clots in my legs. up. That must have been about the time when his lawyer told him, if you'd like to get paid for the rest of your contract, you can't just have quit. You left for health reasons.
So Bobby Ross, just to fill in the backstory real quick, he took the Chargers to the Super Bowl in 1994, did he not?
He did.
But then prior to that, did he not win like a partial national championship with Georgia Tech? There's one of those years where, and I could be wrong, like 1990. I think he was at Georgia Tech, and maybe not. Maybe there's nothing to do with the national championship.
It was. He was 1990. They were co-champs.
Colorado. Okay. Which, had they not called the hold on the Rocket Ismail's return, would have meant that he would have been the undisputed national champion that season. So he takes the Chargers to the Super Bowl. Because I remember they came to Chicago in late 97, the Chargers did, and the Bears kind of knocked them out of the playoffs. And I remember it was kind of like thinking that that's pretty much the end of the Bobby Ross era for San Diego. But then he comes back. So he was actually not a bad coach because
– Well, I mean, how hard is it to coach a team to the Super Bowl with Stan Humphries as your quarterback? I mean,
when
you got talent like that, how can you fail?
But then even with the Lions, he must have been the guy that immediately succeeded Wayne Font. So
yes, he was.
The mid-90s was actually it was halcyon days for Detroit fans, I think, because they must have made the playoffs like 3-4 times. They even won a playoff game in one of those years in 91. But Ross took them to the playoffs, I want to say, a couple times, 97 probably, and maybe 99. And so he probably had one of the highest degrees of success as a Lions coach. And like you say, halfway through 2000, he had seen enough and he gets out of there. Right?
He quit after a loss to the Dolphins. He said, I'm gone. Go away. So far, three guys on this podcast we've talked about have all at some point looked at the Lions and went, this isn't worth it. I'm going.
Right. Like, while they were like in the rare position of succeeding with
Sack franchise. All two shocking retirements and a quitting.
Every time. I'm seeing a theme here.
Yeah.
Okay. Meanwhile, there's a guy, speaking of college coaches, that was given the gift of a plum gig simply after having served as the right-hand man to the legendary Bo Schembechler in Michigan by the name of Gary Moeller. And Moeller, at one point, I think in 1993, in a restaurant in Ann Arbor, Gary Moeller got shit-faced and caused an absolute public spectacle, and that cost him the said plum job with Michigan. And you'd think it might have been the end of his career, but it wasn't, because he resurfaced and found himself in the fortuitous position of inheriting a decent Lions team whose coach Bobby Ross had inexplicably just walked away from.
Yes, the way Wikipedia explains it, Moeller, when he was coaching at Michigan, Moeller resigned in May of 1995 after tapes were released.
Sorry, 95.
Of his alleged drunken outburst following an arrest on a charge of disorderly conduct at the now defunct Excalibur restaurant in Southfield, Michigan on April 28th.
Southfield, all right, Detroit suburbs.
He was succeeded by Lloyd Carr, who had assisted him at both Illinois and Michigan.
Uh-huh, and Carr took him to a title in 97.
Yes.
So,
well, another one of those half things.
That's right. They split that with who? Was it Washington State?
Nebraska.
No. Oh, that's right.
It was kind of a gift for the Huskers. It was a going away present for Tom Osborne. And I didn't care because I don't like Michigan, but Michigan was the best team in the.
And Nebraska did win by like 8 touchdowns in their bowl game.
Yeah.
So that made it hard.
That was back in the days when the bowl games had nothing to do with rankings and teams could run it up.
I just remember that because I spent New Year's Eve in Vegas in 97 and came home with that ticket. And I was able to mail it back to the Stardust for my check.
One of the his 3 years at Illinois were spectacular for Gary Moeller. He had one of my favorite coaching records of all time. In his second season, 1978, Illinois had 1 win, 8 losses, and 2 ties. How many teams tie twice? But then the next year, they were much better. They had 2 wins, 8 losses, and 1 tie.
Oh,
so he coached 33 games at Illinois, and he managed to wrestle 3 of them to a tie. Congratulations.
Yeah. So he was around a long time because he preceded Mike White then. Okay. I'd kind of forgot that Moeller was an Illinois coach.
Yeah, he had a little more success at Michigan, where he went 9-3, 10-2. Holy shit. 9-0-3.
See?
In 1992.
He was doing things in 92. That's okay. Wow.
So the guy coached 8 seasons in college and had 6 ties. How? That's unheard of. I mean,
They didn't have overtime till about 25 years ago.
I know, but come on. I mean, it can't be an accident. At some point, you're playing for a tie. He went to 9-0-3, and they finished the year ranked 5th.
Three ties in 1992. It just seems really, I'll grant it.
So, yes, of the, I got to pull this list up, of the last, the Lions have had, this is no surprise, the Lions have had a lot of coaches. Daryl Bevel is the 28th coach.
I'm more obsessed right now with their interim coaches, because that's kind of a rarity in the NFL. And we've just mentioned Bevel is already, was that just the second one that we've mentioned? But there's probably one or two more if you shake it out in our lifetime. Maybe not. But how many did you say in their history?
Well, I was going to say they have 28 total. We'll look at the interims here in a second. But of the last 16 men to coach the Lions, how many of them do you think survived with a winning record?
Well, Bobby. And
Bobby I bet you not. Bobby was. Oh, you're right. I'm looking at the wrong count. Oh, shit. I better recount this then. No.
Okay.
No. Bobby, 27-30. I was right.
Wow. Okay. I don't think this is the answer, but I just, it's the next logical one would be Wayne Fonts, right?
Wayne, nope. 66-67. He hung on one game too long.
Yes. Was one of them Gary Moeller?
Gary Moeller is one of them.
What was he, 5-4 or 4-3?
He was 4-3.
And so he would have been 5-2.
Second winningest coach in Lions history. No.
He would have been 5-2 had like R.W. McCorders and Paul Edinger not conspired to knock them out of the playoffs in the last game of the 2000 season. And they would have made the playoffs. Okay.
So of the last 16.
Jim Caldwell. Yes. Was he over 500?
Yes, he was. 36-28.
Oh, that's much too good for Detroit. You cannot stay, sir.
Got fired, got replaced by a guy who went 13-28-1.
And that's the guy.
That was Patricia.
That's Patricia.
Yes.
Yeah.
So of the last six, Daryl, actually the last 15, because Daryl hasn't coached a game yet, but I'm confident he's not going to join the list. Two of them winning records. Holy crap. I mean, as much as I loved Tommy Hudspeth and Rick Forzano and Daryl Rogers. Harry Gilmer. Yeah.
Do you have a Daryl Rogers memory? Because the first thing that springs to my mind is that supposedly he once bent over on the sidelines and ripped his pants. I'm not making that up.
I'm sure he did.
I'm sure if you Google, and it's Daryl with a Y, kids, if you want to look that one up. I'm pretty sure he split his pants on the sidelines.
Okay, so interim coaches in Lions history, one of them is a former Bear Coach of the Year.
Oh, Dick Geron!
He had to clean up after they fired the Mooch in 2005.
That was my Ed Obradovich impression.
Dick went 1-4 for the Lions.
That was it. He didn't get a – Because I think Dick Geron may have been an interim coach twice, because I thought he – interim his way into Buffalo and got to stick around for a couple of years. He Malfitano'd it, got to keep the job for them. So, but he only had the 5 games of the Lions.
Yep, just 5.
Geron. Okay.
So Dick was a interim. Gary Moeller was an interim.
Wow, that's 3. We've never had an interim coach, have we?
No, the Bears stick with him until the. Maybe this year would be nice.
The bitter end.
I don't think it's going to happen.
Could happen. If they lose Sunday to an interim, who knows?
That looks like that's it. Although I could be wrong. Actually, what I can't tell from this is if they were an interim and they stuck around for another season, then it's lost to me.
In fact, had Geron continued to coach like I thought he did, then we wouldn't have known. Yeah, I mean, well, I guess are they interim then in that case if they continue on? They were at one
they
time.
Are.
They
had the interim just for the rest of that year, and then you get the full-time job.
It's such a rare thing. It's much more common in baseball.
Oh, yeah, it happens all
the time. Just because there's so many more games. It's so much more because the football season, it's like, well, at some point, if you've lost the season, you're not going to be able to gain it back.
The Cubs were always famous for this. They would fire the manager, and then they'd have to have an interim for just a few days while they went out and hired the new guy. It's like, really? You couldn't have just lined this up? Otherwise, John Vukovich would have never got to manage again. Wasn't he interim twice for the Cubs?
John Vukovich was interim in 86 after Dallas Green fired Fry. And then I want to say that Vukovich may have also, I don't know if Gene Michael finished the season in 87. I think he did. No, he didn't, but he was replaced by Frank Lucchesi. Which is more of a hilarious interim because Frank Lucchesi was in no way going to be the manager the next year. He was like a scouting guy that Green pulled up. He had been a manager in the 70s and famously got the shit kicked out of him by his player, Lenny Randle, future Cub in spring training. And then in 80, when Lee Ely got canned in 83, you know, he had his tirade in May, but then the Cubs did rally, but then they sort of petered out in late August, and he got fired. And Charlie Fox came out and managed the team.
And Charlie went 17-22. They should have kept him.
That team was a little bit on the rise as the following year would follow, but there was no way Charlie was in their plans when
Dallas hadn't imported all of his Phillies yet. So
not he hadn't yeah he had gotten a
he
few
had some I mean, of
Brewster
them.
Was there yeah Moreland was there you know Dickie Knowles was still you know around but my favorite thing about interim coaches is that and we can if we ever do a Cubs thing I'll do a deep dive on how the last days of the Tribune Company 1979 Herman Franks who just is one of the reasons I became a Cubs fan because I was enraptured by this pot-bellied kicking dirt on an umpire man the histrionics were hilarious and they had a decent team they finished 80-82 but Franks walked away with like 2 weeks left in the season so they elevated third base coach Joey Omalfitano to be the manager so season's over Bob Kennedy the general manager former catcher Terry's father goes in and he hires Preston Gomez, who had been a one- or two-time manager in the American and National League in the 70s. Preston Gomez was so bad in his first season that he got fired like 4 months into it. I mean, imagine how bad you have. The 1980 Cubs, I think they lost 98 games. And so a first-year manager not surviving that first year is quite a statement. So they did the same thing they did before because they had a lot of the same staff. In retrospect, the Wrigley family was pretty much done with the team. Going into the 81 season, they're just like, let Joey keep managing the team. So he was actually their manager for. It never felt like he was anything more than interim manager, but the expectations were so low for the Cubs by 1981 that they just let him manage a whole nother strike shortened season. So, as a Cubs fan, we're familiar with interim coaches, so we can relate to
Mike
the
Quadi.
Lions. I think they had three times.
Yeah, Mike Quadi is the perfect example of the interim that you don't keep, no matter what his record is.
No other phrase. Who?
Mike Quadi.
Was he an interim manager that
for Lou?
Yeah,
because when Lou went home.
That's when Lou decided.
And that's when the players decided, hey, let's keep Mike around. And then they were done with him in like April.
So the Cubs even did that twice, which is like the same thing, right? That the Tribune Company was almost. I never thought out what a pair was. That guy. Do we're really kind of detached from everything because we're getting out of here soon. That's a good call. I'll have to sort of re-register that fact. The Quadi was originally an interim manager. Yeah, Lou just wanted to go float in the pool. He was done. Wanted to go home and float in the pool.
So after Gary, he even says here that Mueller finished with a 4-3 record as head coach, making him the only Lions coach since Joe Schmidt to post a winning record during his tenure. That's Mueller has since been joined by Jim Caldwell.
Right.
He had two jobs after he left the Lions. He was a defensive coordinator in Jacksonville. And do you remember where he coached his final two seasons?
No, but I do vaguely remember seeing him on the sidelines, and it might have been with Jacksonville. So enlighten me.
He was the linebacker coach for the Chicago Bears.
Oh, my God.
With Geron, 2002 and 2003.
Oh, I blocked that out, man. Huh. Interesting.
So, the great.
I think somewhere in the recesses of my mind, I have a vague recollection now that you mention it of Mueller. But, you know, the first thing I think of is being enraged, drunk. And I hadn't even realized, like, what a good thing he had. He was doing well with Michigan, but his drinking got in the way. I remember that, and I just remember he nearly took a moribund Lions team. Not moribund, they were decent after Ross, but he almost took them to the playoffs until the Bears, who had no incentive, knocked them out. And Edinger was a rookie, and he boomed like a 51-yarder or something him out.
When you get the chance to hire Marty Morningwig, there is no way you're going to let somebody like Gary Moeller stand in the way. He's got to go. So, Marty, we're going to play Marty Ball.
Are we out of time? Because I just wanted to do a quick one last thing on Marty Morning, because the last time we only talked about one game last time, and we haven't talked about any today, so that's fine. You know, we do this next year. We got plenty if we want to, but there's so much material otherwise. But the game I talked about, everybody will remember. I'm sure Lions fans is the first thing they think about is the year the Bears are in Champaign and they battled the Lions to overtime, and Marty Morning famously elected to kick with the idea that the wind would be in the Bears' face, which he got mocked for, but I always contended. Well, I remember watching that game. There was a point in that drive where Morningwood had a chance to basically confirm the basis of his decision, and he sort of chickened out. And what happened was, all right, so because what happened after we talked about it, I didn't have all my facts straight, so I looked at the game, and it was even more astounding than I remembered. So in this otherwise meaningless game in the 2002 season in Champaign, when the Bears were temporarily out of Soldier Field, they're in overtime. The Lions win the toss. They elect to kick. And the reason was because it was a very windy day. It was late November down in the cornfields. It's like it's probably been worse than it is at the end. From their own 49, Milton converts and gets a first down to Marty Booker. So it's like, oh, yeah, Marty Morning is an idiot. Because now the Bears are across Detroit 37, Leon Johnson 8, Milton incomplete, intended for Stanley Pritchett. Third and 8. Jim Miller at the 35, right? So you're kind of in what would normally be considered field goal range, 52-yarder, but you're – the wind's going to be in your face. Jim Miller pass incomplete, intended for Dustin Lyman. Penalty on Mike Andy. Offense. Morningwig takes the penalty rather than force the Bears into a 4th and 8, which they could try that 52-yarder, but there's the wind, or they can try to convert a first down on a 4th and 8. He takes the penalty, giving the Bears a 3rd and 18. And on the 3rd and 18, Miller completes the Marty Booker for 15 yards. So they actually get further, closer than they would. They get down to the 30-yard line on 4th and 3. This is where I laugh hysterically. Even then, on 4th and 3 at the Detroit 30, the Bears go for it. So in other words, if they went for it from the 30 on 4th and 3, they clearly were not going to go for it 4th and 8 from the 35. They would have tried the field goal. That would have played right in the morning with strategy from the beginning because he knew it the wind. Yep. And so the fact that he took that penalty rather than force the Bears into a 4th and 8, that's the part that was not a bad strategy per se to give the Bears to give the Bears the ball and hope the wind would be a factor. And when the opportunity absolutely presented itself, what does he do? He turtles up and takes the path of least resistance and makes a boneheaded decision. And of course the Bears convert the 4th and 3 from the 30, move on down, eventually kick a more makeable field goal. So I just wanted to revisit that for accuracy's sake, because I always said, I always pointed out that his decision after the decision to kick the ball really undermined that original decision. But it wasn't until I looked at the play by play that I realized just absolutely, how bad that was. So that's it. Well, I'll never speak of Marty Morning's boneheaded decision again.
I mean, I know what Marty was worried about if they'd gone to 4th and 8 was what happened to him on 4th and 3. If you can't stop the combination of Jim Miller to Dez White.
No, I cannot.
Yeah, Dez with a big 5-yard catch on 4th and 3 to keep the drive alive. And then I love how they finished the drive. Leon Johnson for 2 yards. Leon Johnson for 1 yard. Leon Johnson for no gain. Then a 40-yard field goal.
Yeah. So, and Morningwig's name didn't even come till the end. I feel better, frankly, Andy, after what the Bears have been doing for the last 5 weeks and really the last 30 years, getting to explore everything about the Lions during the same time has really sort of created some balance for me. So I appreciate that.
Yeah, it's as bad as things are, we're still not the Lions. We can comfort ourselves with that.
Oh, amen to that.
It's a cold comfort, but a comfort nonetheless.
Yep.
All right. Oh, I haven't even looked ahead to see who do we get to beat up next week. It might be the Houston Texans, but I got to double check.
Yeah, we'll have to stretch that a little bit, but We can do it. Is it the Texans or do they come right back to the Packers?
No, the Packers are the season finale.
Oh, that's right.
Okay. Yeah, the remaining schedule is Texans at Bears on the 13th. Bears at Vikings on the 20th. Bears at the Jaguars on the 27th. Mike Glennon and the Jacksonville Jaguars. And then it all wraps up on January 3rd at home against the Packers. It's going to be a great sprint
to get extra eggnog
for Matt Nagy and the Bears.
Well, the nice thing about looking backwards, as you and I do on this podcast, as opposed to looking forward like you and Mike Pusateri do, is that the events of the field don't really have to challenge us so much.
Yeah, it is. It's terrible that the current podcast, my Monday night podcast is depressing, and then the Tuesday night podcast is always fun to look back and make fun of people, but.
Yeah, glad to be a part of it. You guys do a good job on that, but I know it's hard to do when the team is absolutely that frustrating. So, kudos to you.
Well, I got a lot of experience, got a lot of reps talking about the Cubs over the years.
That's true.
Of recent vintage.
And, a little bit of a template.
And when people say it's a lot easier to make fun of the team when they're bad, it's really not. It's a lot more fun to make fun of a good team because there's always stuff to make fun of. Bad teams are just no fun. So I'm not sure the numbering is right because of some of the pods, the early podcasts with Brat are lost to the ether. But this, of the ones we have, this is the 100th podcast. So I hope you're honored to be on the 100th Discipio/Pointless Exercise podcast.
Whoa.
Yes. It's one podcast for every four listeners, pretty much. Is that right? Something like that.
All right.
All right. Well, then, study up on your Texans. Going to be, we already talked. We mentioned David.
It.
We mentioned David Carr today, and there's going to be some great, great stories about him getting sacked 78 times or whatever it was that one year. But so that's next week.
So I'm just not against the Bears in 04. Yeah.
I'll
bone up on it. I'll be ready.
All right. Well, see you next week then, Mike.
All right, Andy, take it easy.
Many of us have herpes.